All right, so picture this. You're advising a client, and things are getting really heated at work. They feel like they're being targeted, but their harassment case might not be the strongest. What do you tell them?
Well, that's where a case like Westendorf versus West Coast Contractors can be really insightful.
Okay, Westendorf versus West Coast Contractors. Give us the rundown.
It's a 2013 case from the Ninth Circuit, and it's really a goldmine for understanding how retaliation claims work, even when, you know, the original harassment case might not hold up.
So even if you don't have a clear-cut harassment case, you can still win on retaliation. That's interesting.
Exactly. What's fascinating about Westendorf is that it really highlights how you can still succeed with a retaliation claim, even if the court ends up dismissing that initial harassment claim. It's like a safety net.
A safety net. I like that.
Sure.
Okay, so let's break down Westendorf step by step. First, paint us a picture. Who were the key players here and what exactly went down?
All right, so we're back in 2008 in Nevada. Our plaintiff, Jennifer Westendorf, she's working as a project manager assistant for West Coast Contractors. She's only there for about 5 months, but a lot happens in that short time.
Oh, I bet.
We have Dan Jocelyn, her supervisor, and she's claiming that he's making all sorts of inappropriate comments. We're talking sexually explicit jokes, remarks about her body, the kind of stuff that can really create a hostile work environment.
Yeah, that sounds pretty rough. But it wasn't just Jocelyn, right?
No, you're right. She also alleged that a coworker, Patrick Ellis, was also participating in this behavior.
Got it. So two people making these inappropriate comments and jokes.
Yes. And here's where it gets interesting. Westendorf claims that after she complained about the harassment, Jocelyn started retaliating against her.
Oh, okay. So things escalate. What did she do about it? I mean, did she just take it?
Not a chance. In July of that year, she goes straight to the top, to the company president, Mario Ramirez, and files a formal complaint.
Smart move. Go right to the source.
Right. Ramirez then launches an investigation and warns both Jocelyn and Ellis to basically clean up their act.
Okay, so you'd think that would be the end of it, right? Problem solved.
Well, not quite. Just 2 weeks later, Westendorf has another run-in with Jocelyn, and she goes back to Ramirez to complain again.
Oh boy, so it's not over.
And what happens next is a bit unclear. Westendorf claims that she was fired. The company claims she resigned. Whatever actually happened, her time at West Coast Contractors is over.
And that's when the lawyers get involved.
Precisely. Westendorf sues West Coast Contractors, alleging both sexual harassment and retaliation, specifically under Title VII. Now, the district court initially sided with the employer and granted summary judgment on both of those claims.
Okay.
But Westendorf appeals to the Ninth Circuit.
All right. So for those of us who maybe haven't been in a courtroom in a while, can you remind us what summary judgment means and why is this appeal so important?
Sure. So summary judgment basically means the court is looking at the case and saying, look, even if we accept everything the plaintiff says is true, there's still just not enough here to even go to trial. It's like a shortcut.
A shortcut. Yep.
A way for the court to dismiss a case early if they think it's, you know, a clear loser. But here's the interesting part. The Ninth Circuit didn't completely agree with the lower court. They upheld the dismissal of the sexual harassment claim, but get this, they reversed the decision on the retaliation claim.
Hold on. So they agreed with the lower court on harassment, but they disagreed on a retaliation. What's the difference legally, and why does this matter for our listener who might be, you know, prepping for a case like this?
This split decision is crucial because it demonstrates how these two types of claims are actually distinct. Even if the court didn't think that the harassment itself was legally actionable, they were basically saying, hold on, you still can't punish someone just for speaking up about it.
So that's a big deal for employees.
Absolutely. And it's a warning for employers, too. You can't just retaliate against someone for raising concerns, even if you don't think those concerns rise to the level of a legal violation.
All right. So we have two separate claims with two very different outcomes. Let's take a closer look at each of them. First, the sexual harassment claim. What's the legal standard there? Why didn't it hold up in court?
Well, for a hostile work environment claim to succeed, the bar is set pretty high.
High bar.
The conduct has to be so severe or pervasive that it actually changes the conditions of employment. It can't just be a few off-color jokes or some isolated incidents.
So a few inappropriate comments here and there, that's not necessarily going to cut it.
Right. The court really scrutinizes the frequency, the severity, the overall context of the behavior.
So they looked at Westendorf's experience and essentially decided that it didn't cross that line.
That's right. They considered the comments, the jokes, and ultimately determined that, while offensive, they were too sporadic. Remember, this happened over a 3-month period. It just wasn't enough to create that kind of hostile environment that Title VII is designed to prevent.
So for our listener, that's a key takeaway, right? You need more than just a few isolated incidents to win a harassment claim.
Absolutely. You need to show a pattern of behavior that is so pervasive and severe that it creates an environment that a reasonable person would find hostile or abusive.
To give our listeners a better understanding, what would be an example of something that would meet that standard?
Sure. Imagine a scenario where someone is physically assaulted at work or they're constantly bombarded with threats or intimidation. That kind of severity and frequency is much more likely to meet the legal standard for a hostile work environment.
Okay, that makes sense. So Westendorf loses on the harassment front. But what about the retaliation? Why did the Ninth Circuit see that claim differently? This is where things get really interesting for our listener, right? Because even if their client's harassment case is a bit weak, they might still have a shot with retaliation.
You're absolutely right. And to understand why the court ruled the way they did, we need to delve into the framework they use to analyze these types of claims.
Okay, let's do it.
It's called the McDonnell-Douglas framework.
McDonnell-Douglas. Sounds a bit intimidating. Break it down for
us.
What does our listener absolutely need to know about this framework to help their client?
It's not as complicated as it sounds, I promise. The McDonnell-Douglas framework is essentially a three-part test.
Okay, a three-part test.
Right. To win on a retaliation claim, you basically need to show three things. First, that your client engaged in what we call protected activity. Second, that they suffered what's called an adverse action. And third, that there's a connection between the two, a causal link.
Okay, I'm following so far. So protected activity, adverse action, and a link between the two. Got it. Let's take Westendorf's case as an example. Would her complaints to Ramirez about the harassment, would that be considered protected activity?
Absolutely. That's a perfect example. She's speaking out against what she reasonably believes to be unlawful conduct, and that in itself is protected. Even if, you know, her harassment claim doesn't ultimately succeed in court.
Wait, hold on. That's huge. You're saying my client doesn't even have to win the harassment case to be protected from retaliation.
Exactly. It's a common misconception, but it's really important to understand that the law wants to encourage people to speak up.
Yeah.
It doesn't want them to stay silent out of fear of, you know, losing their job or facing other negative consequences.
Makes sense.
So as long as your client has a reasonable belief that they're experiencing unlawful harassment, their complaints are protected, period.
That's really powerful. Okay, so protected activity check. What about that second part, the adverse action? What does that usually look like in these cases?
That one's usually pretty straightforward. It's any negative action that's taken against your client by their employer because of that protected activity. In Westendorf's case, it was the termination or the forced resignation, depending on, you know, whose story you believe.
So losing your job, obviously. What about other things like getting demoted or having your hours cut? Would those count as adverse actions?
Absolutely. All of those could definitely be considered adverse actions. And, you know, the key is to really connect those actions back to the protected activity. And that's where that third element, that causal link, really comes into play.
Okay, so that's the million-dollar question, right?
Yeah.
How do you prove that link? How do you prove that the adverse action was specifically because of the protected activity and not for some other, you know, legitimate reason? Because I'm sure the employer in Westendorf's case probably had their own spin on why she was ultimately let go.
Oh, absolutely they did. And you're right, that's the crux of a lot of these cases. West Coast contractors claim that Westendorf was terminated for insubordination, not retaliation. But here's where things get really interesting and really tricky for employers. The court doesn't just take their word for it. They look for evidence of what we call pretext.
Pretext, there's another one of those fancy legal terms. Can you break that down for us? What does it actually mean in this context?
Sure. Essentially, pretext means that the employer's stated reason for the action, like the termination, it's basically a smokescreen. It's a cover story to hide their true motive, which is retaliation. Think of it as like a fake reason, you know, something they're using to try to justify their actions. And in Westendorf's case, there were some pretty glaring red flags that made the court seriously question whether the employer was being honest about their reasons for letting her go.
Okay. This is what our listeners are waiting for. Give us the juicy details. What were some of those red flags?
All right. Well, the biggest, most obvious red flag was the timing. Remember that 15-day gap between Westendorf's initial complaint and her termination?
Mm.
The court found that incredibly suspicious. It's like, come on, what are the odds that she suddenly becomes insubordinate right after speaking up about the harassment?
Yeah, that seems a little too convenient, but couldn't it be a coincidence? I mean, what if she really was a difficult employee and they were just waiting for the right moment to let her go?
That's actually exactly what the dissenting judge argued.
Okay.
But the majority wasn't convinced. And here's why: there was zero documentation to support their claims about her alleged insubordination. No warnings, no write-ups, nothing. If she was really such a problem employee, wouldn't you think there would be some kind of paper trail?
Yeah, you'd think so. So for our listeners out there, this is another critical takeaway. Documentation is key. If an employer claims that an employee is a problem, but they have absolutely nothing to back it up, that's a huge red flag for pretext.
It's basically a giant neon sign flashing, "We're trying to cover something up."
I like that.
And that's precisely why the Ninth Circuit decided that Westendorf's retaliation claim deserved to go before a jury. They weren't necessarily saying she was going to automatically win, but they were saying that there was enough evidence of pretext, enough suspicion, to warrant a full trial.
So let me just make sure I've got this straight. Even if an employer genuinely believes their reason for firing someone, if the timing is suspicious and there's no documentation to support their claims, that could still be enough to get a retaliation case to a jury.
You got it. That's a huge victory for employees. It means that the court is going to really carefully scrutinize those employer explanations, especially when there's a pattern of behavior that seems a little fishy.
Now, you mentioned earlier that one of the judges actually dissented from this decision. Why did she disagree with the majority? What's the other side of this argument that our listeners need to be aware of?
So, the dissenting judge, Judge Rawlinson, she felt that the court was putting a little too much weight on the timing of everything and not enough on the employer's actual stated reason for the termination. She argued that West Coast Contractors truly genuinely believed that Westendorf was being insubordinate and that their honest belief in that should have been enough to justify their actions, you know, regardless of whether it was actually true or not.
Wait a minute. So even if they were wrong about her being insubordinate, as long as they really believed it, that's it. That's game over.
Yeah.
Doesn't that just give employers way too much leeway? I mean, what's to stop them from just making up an excuse?
It's a valid point, and it really gets to the heart of this debate about how much deference the courts should give employers when it comes to these kinds of decisions. The dissent felt that, you know, without any direct evidence proving that the employer was straight up lying, the court should just defer to their judgment, basically.
But the majority obviously disagreed. What was their reasoning for pushing back on that idea? Because this could be really important for our listeners, especially if they need to convince a judge that the employer isn't being completely truthful.
Well, the majority basically argued that just accepting the employer's word for it, you know, without any scrutiny, would make it way too easy to get away with retaliation. They were emphasizing that, look, even if the employer honestly believes their reason, that doesn't automatically mean it was the real reason.
Right.
There could be unconscious bias, you know, there could be all sorts of things going on beneath the surface.
Okay.
So they said the court still needs to look for that evidence of pretext, like we were talking about earlier. And in this specific case, the timing combined with the lack of documentation was just too suspicious to just brush aside.
So it's not enough for the employer to simply say, oh, we believe she was a problem. They need to have something more concrete.
Right.
They need to actually back it up with evidence. That's a good point for our listeners to remember. If they can demonstrate that the employer's reason is kind of flimsy or unsupported, well, that really strengthens their case for retaliation.
100%. This whole back and forth between the majority and the dissenting opinion, it really highlights a crucial tension in employment law. On one hand, we absolutely want to protect employees from being punished for speaking out about what they believe is wrongdoing. But on the other hand, we also don't want to completely tie the hands of employers and make it impossible for them to effectively manage their workforce.
Yeah, it's a tough balance to strike. And it seems like this is something that the courts are constantly grappling with. But at the end of the day, in Westendorf's case, the majority sent a pretty clear message. You can't just hide behind a flimsy excuse when all the circumstances point to retaliation.
Exactly. You can't just expect to get away with it. And that's a powerful takeaway for anyone out there who might be facing a similar situation. Even if you don't have a slam dunk harassment case, if you can demonstrate that your employer's actions were motivated by retaliation, well, you've got a fighting chance.
All right. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Westendorf versus West Coast Contractors, what's the bottom line for our listeners? What are the key takeaways they should be walking away with today?
I'd say there are three really big ones. First, retaliation claims. They stand on their own. They have their own legal merit. You don't have to win your initial harassment or discrimination case to win on retaliation. Second, timing is absolutely critical. If you can show a clear and close connection between your protected activity, like making a complaint, and the negative action taken against you, that is a huge red flag for potential retaliation. And finally, documentation, documentation, documentation. I can't stress this enough. Make sure you're keeping really detailed records of everything that's happening, because that paper trail could end up being your strongest weapon.
This has been a really insightful deep dive. Westendorf versus West Coast Contractors is a case that I think every employment lawyer, and frankly, every employee should know about. It really shows how the law can protect people who decide to speak up, even when it feels like the odds are stacked against them.
It's a great reminder that we all have the right to a workplace that's free from harassment and retaliation, and that if those rights are violated, well, the courts can help us find a path to justice.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Westendorf versus West Coast Contractors. We'll see you next time for another fascinating exploration of the legal world.